Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At the age of 40, William Shakespeare was in the prime of his career, a top playwright in London, high on the success of Hamlet, with a stack of popular plays, some of the greatest works in the English language, already to his name. He could have stopped right there and been a god of literature, but he was also a man, with rent to pay, actors to feed, and a very real, everyday London life to lead. In a time of King James, the plague, family drama, and a bustling life in the streets, he wrote through it all, comedies and tragedies, including this, in 1605, from King Lear.
Does any here know me? This is not Lear. Who is it that can tell me who I am?
Lear's shadow.
This hour on Point, we make Shakespeare's world real with the author of a remarkable new look at the Bard in London at 40, 400 years ago. We're joined this hour from London by Charles Nichols, historian, biographer, and travel writer. He's author of the acclaimed book about Shakespeare's great contemporary and rival, The Reckoning, The Murder of Christopher Marlowe. His new book is The Lodger Shakespeare, His Life on Silver Street. Charles Nichols, thanks for being with us.
Hello, it's Nickel, actually.
Nickel, excuse me. I'm very sorry, of course. It's right
singular.
Right here in front of me, a singular Nickel, and we're very happy to have you. You're taking us back.
My pleasure.
400 years, and all of this off of a deposition by William Shakespeare. There's so much we're going to learn about him in this hour, but what was that about, and what was he involved in that ended up coming down 1909, pulled out of a stack of papers in the London Public Records? But what was Will Shakespeare testifying about?
Well, it was a family dispute in the Court of Requests in Westminster, which was something equivalent to our small claims courts that we still have here in England. He was giving evidence in a family dispute about a dowry or marriage settlement, which the son-in-law in question claimed had not been paid to him by the father-in-law.
And Will Shakespeare knew them all and is asked to stand up and tell the court what he knows about what was promised and the relationships there.
Yes. Well, it's a kind of message in a bottle, this document. It's Shakespeare in the witness stand, both interesting in itself for the fact he's there, his physical presence. This deposition or witness statement is really the only record of Shakespeare speaking. Of course, a lot of it is full of legalistic cotton wool, but the nub of it, where he actually gives answers to the court's questions, is Shakespeare speaking. So that in itself is exciting. What he has to say is perhaps less exciting unless you start to look round the corner of it. He's asked what he thinks about the people involved, the father and the son-in-law and the daughter. The mother in question is now dead. He's asked if he can remember what was promised to the son-in-law, which he claims he can't. Mm. He says he remembers the young man as a good, honest and industrious servant. The upshot of this is that although Shakespeare's answers are somewhat bland in themselves, what it gives us is a precious nugget of information, because the reason why Shakespeare is there giving evidence is because he used to be a lodger in the house of this family.
Hence your title, The Lodger Shakespeare, and you look, and there right at the bottom of his deposition, that the kind of familiar signature, one of just half a dozen Shakespeare signatures that remain from that time.
Indeed.
You pick up on this deposition and use it as a kind of a passkey into a life and an entire era. He was a lodger with this family on Silver Street in London. I guess first remind us of where Shakespeare was in his career at, what, age 40 or so, in these years 1603, 4, 5, when he was a lodger. Why? He'd already had performed many of his plays. He'd already come to quite a degree of public note. Why was he a lodger? Was he a man of means?
Indeed, he was. I suppose one might call it his apartment in town. A number of the writers, his contemporaries, were lodgers because that's all they could afford. Shakespeare was a lodger because it was convenient for him to live in London. He was indeed a property owner, but he, for reasons known to himself, preferred to make his property investments in and around his home town of Stratford-upon-Avon. So he converted his wealth, and he was earning quite considerably by this stage, into bricks and mortar. But in London he preferred, for reasons, well, perhaps one can guess at some of the reasons, he preferred the anonymity, the freedom, the mobility of lodgings. Excuse me.
So Anne Hathaway, his wife, is up in Stratford-on-Avon. He's got, I think you write, three houses at that point in Stratford and some 100-plus hectares of land to boot. But that's hometown and not where he's residing.
That's right. He was quite a considerable land and householder in Stratford. A local boy made good, if you like. He'd gone off to the city. He'd made his money in the really still rather dubious and unrespectable profession of playwright and indeed to begin with actor or player. The insubstantial world of the theatre, which he converted into the more substantial matter of bricks and mortar and good arable land.
And you call him marvelling at the ability, the capacity for that to be, the fact that that could be done, that words could be changed into land and mortar.
That's right. Well, I mean, one of the things that Shakespeare is he's in the forefront of the idea of writing as a commercial operation. So all of us that actually earn their living by, all of us that earn our living by our pens are grateful to Shakespeare and that generation of writers, not just him alone, of course, who really moved writing out of the sort of gentlemanly hobby kind of level into something what we would consider commercial writing. No whiff of royalties as yet, but he was able to convert, as you say, words into money and money into stone and mortar.
Remind us where he was in his career. Major works behind him, and many of them already at this point. He'd been writing since 1590 or so. He had The Taming of the Shrew and Romeo and Juliet, Merchant of Venice, As You Like It, Henry V, Much Ado About Nothing, Hamlet in 1601, that and much more already, Twelfth Night, Julius Caesar, all already written. Yes. And performed. What was his public reputation and standing at this point in terms of as a dramatist?
Well, very high is the answer. He was very popular. He was probably already acknowledged as the best around, although there was some good competition coming up from the younger writers like Ben Jonson and Thomas Middleton. He'd shaken off his only real rival for that crown earlier on with the death of Christopher Marlowe back in 1593. Marlowe, his contemporary in age, but much senior to him as a writer in terms of how soon he got off the mark. During Marlowe's lifetime, Shakespeare certainly would have considered him, Marlowe, the master. But Shakespeare, by 1600, 1601, as you say, the performance of Hamlet, a kind of watershed, certainly as we look back on it now, and I think as people saw then, a play that went deeper under the skin of a late Elizabethan, a medieval Danish prince, but obviously in all other respects a fashionably melancholy and philosophical, well-born young Elizabethan. I'd say after Hamlet, one really finds him in that kind of uneasy landscape after the production of a masterpiece, where his reputation is assured by what he's done, but his way forward is uncertain, to some extent unmapped. And the plays that characterise the particular period that I've been writing about are what are still sometimes called, a slightly old-fashioned label, but still sometimes called the problem plays, because no one can quite work out exactly how they're sort of pitched. Are they meant to be funny? Are they meant to be tragic? Are they meant to be tragicomedies, which in fact probably is the correct answer? Their whole mood is rather elusive and slightly unwholesome.
They're with Measure for Measure and All's Well That Ends Well. And, of course, he's in the same period, 1603 to 1605. Othello is there. King Lear is there.
Yes, I mean, one's slightly guessing because approximating because precise dates of the plays are difficult to come by. One often knows the date of a first recorded performance. It's not necessarily the first performance, and it's not necessarily that the play was mint fresh when it was recorded as being performed. But broadly speaking, in chronological, over the 1603 to 5, you could say the chronology runs Othello, Measure for Measure, All's Well That Ends Well, Timon of Athens, and then just the beginnings of King Lear, which is first recorded performances in late 1606.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about 2 years in the life of William Shakespeare. Shakespeare at 40, midway in his career, where he lived, what he saw, who he knew, Shakespeare's London, in 1603 to 1605, maybe. My guest is Charles Nicol. He joins us from London. He's author of the quite wonderful new book, The Lodger, Shakespeare, His Life on Silver Street. Here's Ian Holm, starring as King Lear in the 1998 BBC adaptation of the play. In this scene, he's just taken away the dowry of his youngest daughter, Cordelia, because he thinks she doesn't love him enough. Here, suitors from France and Burgundy duke it out for Cordelia's hand.
My lord of Burgundy, what say you to the lady? Will you have her? She is herself a dowry.
Royal King, give but that portion which yourself proposed, and here... I take Cordelia by the hand. Duchess of Burgundy! Nothing! I have sworn I am firm.
Charles Nicol takes a legal deposition from that time about a diary, and from it spins an entire world. With Shakespeare at the heart of it, he joins us from London. Right, we've got plenty of callers who want to speak with you, Mr. Nicol. Carrie's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air with Charles Nicol.
Oh, hi, Tom. Welcome back. I missed you.
Thank you.
I devour books and hate reading plays, so I don't know why I got hooked by Shakespeare. I guess because it's been performed enough that I've been able to watch and listen rather than read.
Yeah.
My Hungarian father-in-law used to swear that no one could understand that English. He didn't think that we got into the rhythm after we were watching for a while. He denied we even knew what was going on. One of the things I found very interesting is reading Dark Lady, a lovely novel suggesting Shakespeare really was a woman. And then the second theory I have is that they were all written by a committee. They often stole information from one another, and although Shakespeare was a real person, I don't believe he wrote all of those wonderful plays. And one of the theses I put forward in college was that James Fenimore Cooper was our Shakespeare. He wrote about what he knew, and their time and place. But I've been a devout fan, loved it. Collections have everything I can get on him. So this is wonderful to find a new book.
Carrie, that's terrific. And you put a lot out there that we can pick up on. It's picked up on in the pages of Charles Nicol's book. Thanks for your call. Charles Nicol, there's a big fan. And several things she hits on right out of the gate, not least of which her Hungarian father or father-in-law who doubts the whole doubts the whole infatuation. Foreignness. Here we had Shakespeare. He was a lodger in the home of French immigrants, Huguenot immigrants to London. And you write about how foreignness and the backdrop and characters of a foreign quality inform so many of his plays, maybe in part through his association with this family.
Yes, I always feel that the idea of the foreign and the foreign settings is a kind of key for Shakespeare to that takes him off into the imagination and into that sort of slightly magnified and distorted version of reality which he puts on stage. There's not a single one of his 37 canonical plays that is actually set in Elizabethan or Jacobean England, even though he is the greatest playwright of Elizabethan and Jacobean England. They're either set back in time, in which case some of them are in England, of course, the histories, or they're in various slightly fantastical, exotic settings. I say fantastical because there's various cases in which he gets his geography wrong, like giving Bohemia a seacoast and so on. So there's an idea that those foreign-sounding places, as far as we know, he never travelled to any of them. Some people have tried to show that his Italian settings, of which there are many, were based on first-hand knowledge, but they're so full of sort of mistakes and vaguenesses that one really feels that the argument goes the other way.
It's less about, I guess, the factuality of foreign settings, as the liberty that they provide him to look in a different way, a magnified or a kind of off-center way at human nature, as you describe it.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the characters obviously within these exotic settings are thoroughly English. You don't really need to go to Illyria, which is nowadays Croatia, in order to find someone like Sir Toby Belch. In fact, you do much better searching for him around the corner in Southwark. But it's that wonderful sort of transformation. It's that idea of transformation, which of course is Shakespeare's idea of the theatre. It holds the mirror up to nature, but also it transforms, and he does move, particularly in his later plays, the so-called romances, towards a rather magical, almost sort of conjuring idea of what the theatre can show and how it can impact upon the audience. And his last sort of fully written protagonist is indeed the magician Prospero, whose skill at conjuring and whose ideas of sort of magical power are to some extent a metaphor for Shakespeare's own powers as an imaginative writer.
Now, Carey raises a couple of other points which practically verge onto one another in your telling here. One, the sort of dark lady, she's got the thesis out there that Shakespeare himself was a woman, but dark women, you write about his infatuation there, husbandly virtues of that Anne Hathaway might have imposed. She wasn't there. And then the issue of who wrote these plays, and you've got him in the company of some kind of unsavory characters, one of whom played a part in writing Shakespeare.
Yes, indeed. That's a collaboration, which, of course, is very, very distinct from the idea being put forward by your listener that Shakespeare himself didn't write the plays, but they were put together by this anonymous committee. I think these sort of ideas are probably okay among consenting adults in private, but there's no historical evidence at all for any kind of tomfoolery of that sort in terms of the authorship question. But there certainly was a great deal of collaboration between actual flesh and blood living authors like Shakespeare and others that he collaborated with, one of whom is the great rising star Thomas Middleton, with whom he who wrote part of Timon of Athens. But the one I particularly concentrate on, partly because he is a connection of the family with whom Shakespeare was living, is a man called George Wilkins. And George Wilkins, like Shakespeare, is called upon to give evidence in the lawsuit. The family that Shakespeare was living with, the Mountjoys, they are a family involved in the fashion business. As you say, they're French immigrants. And they're quite upmarket family, but also what I would call rather rackety. There's some evidence of Marie Mountjoy, Shakespeare's landlady, having an extramarital fling or two. That's evidence found in the case books of a medical practitioner and astrologer who she consulted. And among their acquaintances was this character, George Wilkins. He describes himself in his deposition as a victualler, in other words, a pub keeper or innkeeper. He'd hardly describe himself as a brothel keeper, which is probably a
closer
more accurate
to the point.
Description.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Indeed, or indeed a pimp. So one wonders about Shakespeare's association with him. But as well as being a brothel keeper and a pimp, George was an aspiring author in the year 1605. And in that year, his first known venture into print is indeed to write a play for the King's Men, Shakespeare's theatre company. And in that same year, the daughter of the Mountjoys, Mary, and her husband, Stephen, the ones who later bring in the lawsuit, are lodging with George Wilkins. So you get their...
Tangled web.
Yes, exactly. You get what I call this sort of intersection of the normally legible world of authors and their texts with the normally unrecorded world of lodgers, neighbours and in-laws and so on. And that's the real sort of secret of this book, I think, or the real what drew me into it was this idea that you have this whole stratum of, as it were, ordinary life. I'm making the inverted commas sign with my fingers there. You can't see me. You know, can Shakespeare have had an ordinary life? Well, of course, an ordinary-seeming life that Shakespeare lived. And this deposition and the other depositions that go with it and the scenes and characters and neighbourhoods that it takes us into tell us at least something in a fragmentary sense about Shakespeare's daily circumstances while he was writing these great plays. And the play with which he collaborated with George Wilkins was Pericles. And I draw some parallels with one or two moments in Pericles with the circumstances, just as there are parallels between that little passage of King Lear that you you featured a few minutes ago. He's writing that in 1605. What the Duke of Burgundy is complaining to King Lear, give but that portion which you promised, is exactly what Christopher Mountjoy's son-in-law is complaining to him.
Where's my dowry? You promised me.
Yes,
let's go.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly the argument. And it's going on downstairs while Shakespeare's up in this chamber writing King Lear. Obviously, I'm putting it a bit simplistically, but it's extraordinary how one gets these little tie-ins. And, of course, one has this idea that in this case, we have a little probe, a little light that shines down into Shakespeare's circumstances at this time. Most of the plays, he's writing them against a blank canvas in that sense. We don't know what he was doing. We don't know exactly who he was living with. We can't gauge and spot those little moments of particularity that come into the plays that one sees that he wrote there on Silver Street.
We don't normally picture William Shakespeare, at least I don't anyway, as collaborating with a pimp and aspiring author on major works. I mean, I know he cranked them out at an incredible rate, a couple of years often.
Yes.
Which is just astounding to consider. But what did collaboration mean? How often did he do that? And when he collaborated, what did that mean? I write a page, you write a page?
Well, I think division of acts more likely. Mm-hmm. It was a fairly common thing. I'm not sure that Shakespeare was sort of temperamentally suited to it as well as some others. Some playwrights basically hardly ever wrote a sole-authored work, although they would be what we'd nowadays consider them all minor playwrights of the period. The plays, although, you know, we find this tremendously rich and resonant poetry that Shakespeare wrote, and indeed some of the others, like Middleton and Jonson and Marlowe, rich and complex literature, there is nonetheless a wonderful sense at which these works are just knocked out. Of course, they're knocked out within the context of performance, or for performance, and probably with quite a lot of input from the actors. Shakespeare himself was an actor, so before he was an author. So, and indeed, he continued to act. Mm-hmm. We know one or two plays he did act in, and there's a tradition that he played the ghost in Hamlet. There's a tradition he played older men, probably because he was rather early afflicted by
balding,
as he always is in all the pictures of him that we know of.
Wonderful picture.
So, collaboration, you know, it seems a little odd to us with our rather more, as it were, patrician idea of the author as a great sort of legislator of our feelings.
But he had a troop to feed. He had to keep the plays coming.
He had a troop to feed or a troop to keep in work, and he had a family to feed back home, another kind of troop back home, or quite a small one. But and
he had lost a son before this time. What had the twins, Judith, and then the son he lost died at 11 or so and had an older daughter. Were they all in Stratford?
That's right. They were all in Stratford. His son, Hamnet, named after a friend of his in Stratford, died at the age of 11, as you say, in 1596. And a father scarred by the loss of a son. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, they were used to it. But, of course, who was ever used to the death of a son?
Right.
And there is, as I mentioned, that Shakespeare is traditionally said to have played the ghost of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, there is. There are two different names, in fact, but there's this kind of assonance between Hamnet, his dead son, and Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark.
Yeah.
And the idea that Shakespeare himself was playing Hamlet's father, except that the father is the ghost, but in real life the son is the ghost. It's a very, very complex and resonant sort of psychological situation.
I'd say you can imagine that ghost wouldn't go away easily. Let's take a call from Mike in Polly's Island, South Carolina. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Hi, Miss Jacob.
Hello.
Hello. My question is, I believe Queen Elizabeth died in 1603, the period we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
What, from your research, what did Shakespeare think of Queen Elizabeth? And when she died, do you think it affected him personally, or was it reflected in his plays?
That's an interesting question, because there were contemporaries of Shakespeare who muttered somewhat about the fact that Shakespeare didn't trot out, as many of the others were, a sort of funeral elegy mourning the passage of the great, or the passing of the great queen. So people on the ground in 1603 were wondering why Shakespeare, in many ways the leading author, or certainly the leading playwright of his day, wasn't commemorating the occasion. I don't know the answer as to why he wasn't. Perhaps, probably more, that he didn't feel it was his kind of writing to do that sort of public elegy or commemoration. But as a playwright, he really prospered more under King James, who was the one who took over the throne on the death of Elizabeth. King James of Scotland, who came down to England and ushered in what we now call the Jacobean Age. And, of course, Shakespeare's straddling right across that borderline, or as we see it, a borderline between the Elizabethan, which is full of optimism and colour and glitter and excitement, and the Jacobean Age, which is seen as a more cynical and more dark and more moody sort of and slightly decadent period. His personal relationship with Elizabeth would be very difficult to gauge. Indeed, I'd even say if he had one. He was a playwright, and as such, if he crossed Queen Elizabeth's radar, which he certainly did, it was only as an entertainer. It's rather telling that in the coronation procession for King James in 1604, in fact it was delayed because of the plague, it should have been in 1603, Shakespeare, as one of the king's players, he'd been named, his troupe had been named the Royal Troupe for King James. They were the king's men from now on. But in the coronation procession, they're ranked as grooms of the chamber, which is a sort of rank, and then they're under the heading falconers, etc.
Not exactly so the highest tiers of those celebrating.
Exactly right. So they're sort of rather kind of backstairs, you know, falconers, etc., you know, odd bods who sort of, you know, help us to pass the time on one of our picnics. So that, I think, gives us that one's always looking for those sort of shifts of perspective. We see Shakespeare as a sort of great, all-embracing, universal genius of literature. And of course he is, which is why we're all sort of still talking about him 400 years later. But at the time, he was a figure to some extent on the fringes of the court, on the fringes of respectability even.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Charles Nickel. He joins us from London. He's author of the new book, The Lodger, Shakespeare, His Life on Silver Street, looking at just about 2 years in the life of William Shakespeare. He was about 40 years old, midway in his career, looking very closely at where he lived, what he saw, who he knew, Shakespeare's London, just at that time, between when Elizabeth on her way out, King James on the way in, and a fascinating book in its detail about the real world surround this great figure in English literature. Charles Nickel joins us from London. Here's a bit from one of the plays he wrote during this time when he produced Measure for Measure and All's Well That Ends Well, King Lear and Othello. In 1952, Orson Welles produced and starred in a film version of Othello. In this scene, Othello, played by Welles, rages at his wife, Desdemona, played by Suzanne Clautier, because he suspects her of infidelity.
Would thou hadst never been born?
Alas, what ignorant sin have I committed?
Committed?
did. Ah, the public commoner! I should make very forges of my cheeks that would to cinders burn up modesty, did I but speak thy deeds! Not committed! Heaven stops the nose at it, and the moon winks. The body wind that kisses all it meets is hushed within the hollow mind of earth, and will not hear it. What committed!
Charles Nickel, there, a bit from Othello. You write that you're cautious about drawing lines too tightly between the real life of anyone, Shakespeare included, between their biography and their output, their art. But what about Othello? Do you see, here he is, he's living with the other, in a way, French Huguenots, where he's lodging. Do you see some kind of, webbing here between this play and Shakespeare's life at the time?
Yes, I think you can. You do have to be very cautious about it. I think there was a strong reaction to sort of biographical interpretations of the plays, because, you know, it's very easy to sort of unregulated and rather sentimentalized sort of cherry picking of the of certain sort of speeches from certain plays and saying this is what Shakespeare thought, or this is reflects his own experiences and so on. I prefer to do it on the basis of, as we were talking about a little earlier, that idea that certain fragments from his daily domestic life find their way into the plays. You know, he's a great opportunist. There's that wonderful phrase in which he describes the sort of pickpocket and tinker Autolycus in The Winter's Tale, a snapper-up of unconsidered trifles. And he's rather like that himself, Shakespeare. There's this sort of idea that whatever's there, there's this wonderful inclusiveness about his writing. And as I said, normally there's this stratum of personal allusion, which we just aren't able to catch. But in this case, one can. With the Othello, I mean, I looked at Othello because it does fall pretty squarely into this period when he's lodging with the Mountjoys. And I say, well, you know, there's a lot of differences between an African soldier or condottiere in Venice and a French hat maker or tire maker, as he's called, a maker of ornate headgear in Cripplegate. But there's also some similarities, you know, this idea of the immigrant, this idea of someone whose status, however sort of good they are, their status is always very fragile because they are the outsider, the stranger of here and everywhere, as Iago calls Othello. You know, they're rootless. You know, I live abroad myself from my own country, so I have some sensitivity, although I'm not an exile or a refugee like Christopher and Marie Mountjoy.
You just flew in from Italy. Is that where your home
is? Yes,
I
live in Italy, so, you know, it's a very pleasant exile.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a good place to write about Jacobean London from on a logistical point, but on the other hand, so little of Jacobean London remains that it is a kind of exercise of the imagination as well as of research to recreate it.
I love some of the detail of how Shakespeare may have pulled things up from his world that ended up in his plays, but it may have worked the other way, too. You find a record of a baby born in his neighborhood during this time and named, of all things, Cordelia.
That's right.
The name right out of King Lear. And you note that was a very uncommon name. Perhaps old Will Shakespeare suggested it to his neighbor for his new daughter.
Well, I run with that one a little. You know, I allow myself to run with these ideas without sort of pretending that one can say it as in a definitive sort of historical way. But, yeah, the play wasn't, as far as we know, yet performed in late 1605, when this embroiderer, in fact, Mr. William Taylor, who lived around the corner near Silver Street in the same parish, gave birth, or his wife, I should say, obviously gave birth to this daughter. And yes, the name Cordelia, very unusual. And if he got it from Shakespeare, he didn't get it from the play, which hadn't yet been performed. He got it from the man himself. Of course, you know, one could argue the other way around. Perhaps Shakespeare got it from Cordelia Taylor, but
maybe they'd been dreaming of it, talking about it to the neighbors. We're going to name her Cordelia, and then it went to King Lear. Who knows? Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee, if I may. Hal, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Mr. Nickel, I have a geographical question. My London A to Z gives two Silver Streets, one in Enfield, which, as you know, is about as far north as London gets, and the other sort of north of Tottenham and Finsbury Park, a little bit further.
Also a long way away.
Yeah, which
is
Silver
it?
Street.
As you might have surmised, it's neither of them. Silver Street, the Silver Street that Shakespeare knew probably went up, or definitely went up in flames in the Great Fire of London. It
World
was indeed
War II,
then,
or you mean earlier than that,
well,
and then
the
again
Fire
bombed
of London
in World
of 1666. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. then it was rebuilt. But then the final death blows were dealt to it by, first of all, the German bombers of 1940, which flattened the entire area, and then the redevelopment and traffic planning that followed after that. So I could pace you out where Silver Street is, but it isn't a street anymore. It doesn't exist as such. And I believe the nearest one can get to the site of the Mountjoy's house where Shakespeare lodged in and around 1604 is down in an underground car park just off the Barbican estate, which is the big modern housing estate that grew up on that in that area.
We're a long way from old timbers there. I wonder if you could read a little bit from us. There's just a short description you've got here, which may sort of put us in the mind of what it might have been like then, not an underground parking garage.
This was Shakespeare's London habitat, or one of them, in the first years of King James. We find it a leafy neighbourhood with secretive walled gardens. Birdsong mingles with the noises of trade. The aroma of medicinal herbs vies with chimney smoke, cooking smells, and cesspits. We note the area's association with doctors and surgeons, and the macabre arts of anatomy. We scent prosperity. Goldsmiths and usurers and grave-looking guildsmen on their way to the livery hall. Shakespeare lodges in a quiet, well-to-do street, an urban backwater. Though, as always in London, you are not far from the more pungent life of the city, the taverns and inn-yards of Wood Street, the girls down Love Lane, the penury of the hole at the Counter Prison.
Charles Nicol, reading from the Lodger Shakespeare. You make a good deal of some of that last, the taverns and inn-yards and the girls down Love Lane, implication being that he and his collaborator George Wilkins may have spent a fair amount of time there. Shakespeare, far from Anne Hathaway. What do you say there?
Well, if that's how you... Yes, I never actually sort of go out as far as to say that, but you might surmise that's one of the possibilities. Yeah. Well, his association with Wilkins obviously leads him into a squalid sort of stratum of London life. I don't sort of necessarily go for the sort of roistering, rumbustuous side of things, that I don't really see Shakespeare as that sort of man. Mm. If he's involved with prostitution, it's not a sort of merry wenching kind of involvement. It is more like the Dark Lady sort of atmosphere of those Dark Lady sonnets, which are full of sort of sexual guilt and sort of ambiguities.
But it's a very real and present part of the London he inhabits, as you describe it, and a secret to no one.
Very much so, and indeed the family with whom he lodged, the Mountjoys, they made these wonderful things called tyres. He was described as a tyre maker. It doesn't mean he was a member of the Jacobean motor trade.
Feathered headband, sort of
headgear,
fashion.
Yeah, if you think of sort of tiara, the mm-hmm. word tyre isn't actually connected etymologically to tiara, but if you think of a sort of elaborate tiara, you think of a portrait of Queen Elizabeth, she's wearing this sort of wonderful sort of wedding cake on her mm-hmm. head. It's mm-hmm. a sort of structure of wires filled with jewels and feathers and worked into the hair, in fact including wig, that the Mountjoys would also have made. This was also a style of dress or fashion accessory, much favoured by the perhaps rather more upmarket courtesans and prostitutes. So not only does Shakespeare's London, have sort of brothels by the yard in certain mm-hmm. areas of the city, mm-hmm. Some of them are perhaps actually knocking on the door downstairs as he writes his plays, such as Measure for Measure, which is all about the sort of dangers of prostitution and sexual corruption in the city.
These customers of his landlord.
Indeed, they're customers who are there to buy high fashion items, but The landlord himself is, he's accused by the French church, which is a good Calvinist church, so probably their eyes are open for this sort of thing, of all sorts of sexual misdemeanours after the death of his wife, Marie, after the death of Shakespeare's landlady, so one wouldn't necessarily blame him for consorting with the ladies that they claim he consorted with, but no paragon of virtue, and nor, it seems, was she, and... I, of course, perhaps more than the question of whether Shakespeare consorted with prostitutes from time to time, wonder whether he had a bit of a fling with his amorous French landlady, Marie.
Yeah, yeah.
Mrs. Mountjoy, as she's generally referred to in the brief paragraphs that she's given in the usual biographies, it sounds rather like a battle axe, his landlady, Mrs. Mountjoy, but she's actually in her mid-30s when he comes to the... comes to stay there, and as I say, there's evidence she had affairs elsewhere.
And so did landlord with a couple of children, as I recall reading off the hired help in the house. Let's get a call from Cabot, Vermont, and Ellie. Hi, Ellie.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your show.
Thank you so much.
I'm an actress, and I'm doing The Winter's Tale. I know it's a little bit later than his period, but. We are doing essentially a tragic comedy play, and we're sort of puzzled by laugh lines in the middle of incredibly intense, heavy scenes, and I wondered if your guest could say anything about who these plays were being performed for or anything that would explain just how this would have been received.
Laugh lines in the midst of really intense, tough stuff, and suddenly there it is.
Sorry, are we talking about a Shakespeare play here that you're producing?
Yeah.
Or
In this case, A Winter's Tale, which maybe is 1610 or so. But you write about this, Charles, about the tragic comic as a vein that he minds deeply. You imagine his bookshelf in these years of 03, 05, and write on it Ovid and the Metamorphoses and that connection back to Greek and Roman literature and perspective. But what about Shakespeare and the tragic comic, the laugh line in the tough scene?
Yes, well, he this is very much a feature of the plays he was putting out in this sort of period. This mixing of moods, this sort of playing with the audience's expectations, if you like. So one sees this sort of sudden switches, which makes the overall tone of the play very hard to assess, and perhaps that's an effect that he's looking for. The Winter's Tale, I suppose, is slightly different because it's... belongs to the later plays, as you say, and is more what one calls the romances, which is again a mixing of sort of a dramatic modes or dramatic moods, but more the tragic and the pastoral, I say, are the two that are mixed in The Winter's Tale. But I think Shakespeare is always a writer who's ready to surprise. And the tragicomic gave him, he in these plays that he wrote in Silver Street, he's really at the forefront of this rather experimental medium, as it was then, this idea that you can sort of pull the audience one way and then take them the other way and make them challenge their own assumptions and about what they're expecting to see, about the characters, about how the characters are sort of going against their own sort of expectations, as it were. Mm. And he brings these characters through these strange sort of rather twisted sort of plots. Do they learn anything on the way? Does the audience learn anything on the way? All's well that ends well. Well, does it really? Mm. There's a sort of questioning temper. He was very influenced at this time by the French essayist Montaigne, who was translated in 1603 by an acquaintance of Shakespeare's, John Florio. Montaigne's great motto, Que sais-je? What do I know? What do I know, as opposed perhaps to what do I erroneously think that I know?
Sounds like a great phrase for middle age. Charles Nickel, we've just got a minute. What did you end up, after all this research, weaving all of this around life and work, in terms of understanding the personality of William Shakespeare? I mean, did you come away with a different sense of it, or what new coloring did all this research add for you?
Yes. Well, I'm going to dodge that one slightly by saying he is a very elusive character. and I think an elusive character now. Perhaps he was an elusive character then. I indeed see his sojourn on Silver Street as a kind of bolt hole away from the theatrical world. It's a rather quiet neighbourhood, as suggested in that little bit I read. John Aubrey said he was not a company keeper. The great 17th century biographer or biographical sketch writer said of Shakespeare, he was not a company keeper. There's a sort of solitary core to him, although in a very gregarious sort of profession. You mentioned his output. Well, you know, no author produces that sort of high-level output and high production while also being a sort of cheerful and life and soul of the party. I think the thing about the book is really that, you know, Shakespeare was an extraordinary person, but if you see him for a moment in ordinary circumstances, you make, for just a sort of moment, a kind of contact with that extraordinary man.
And that we're very grateful for. Charles Nicholl's new book is The Lodger, Shakespeare, His Life on Silver Street. Mr. Nicholl, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.